This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. This is one of the most difficult shows we have ever done, coming in the wake of the death of Bruce Dixon, a co-founder of Black Agenda Report. We'll have comments and commentary by his colleagues. A committee in Congress has been collecting powerful testimony on the need for reparations for the descendants of enslaved persons in the United States. And Mumia Abu-Jamal confronts the soul-chilling fact that he may be going blind.
But first, Bruce Dixon, the managing editor of Black Agenda Report, was scheduled to speak at a number of panels at the Left Forum, the yearly conference of left-wing activists in New York City. However, Dixon succumbed to blood cancer only days before the event. The entire conference was in mourning for Dixon. The former Black Panther and lifelong activist who co-founded BAR in 2006 and was a key force in the Green Party, BAR executive editor Glenn Ford, remembered his comrade.
This is the kind of talk that I don't know how to give and never wanted to give. We have to pay all respects and I think collectively thank Bruce Dixon for the service that he has rendered to the struggle for peace, for human dignity, for Black liberation, and hopefully for socialism in this country and the world. Bruce was a real soldier, a soldier in the sense that he was willing and eager to take on any aspect of the liberation struggle and to explore all of the questions that face us with the aim of creating the most efficient mechanisms for movement politics. Bruce had been a soldier in the Black Panther Party under Fred Hampton in Chicago. And in the decades after the crushing of the party, Bruce was that organizer who would go into the housing projects and find out what the folks in the project were talking about and what kind of slogans actually organically would flow from the people's analysis of the conditions that they were facing in the projects or at work sites. That's what I mean, examining all aspects of the problem. Bruce admitted that he became addicted to the bourgeois electoral political game, but it was the only one that folks were playing in Chicago, and it took folks a long time to see that that game was going nowhere. But when I met Bruce, it was 2002, and he moved to Atlanta. And I remember we had just done a piece in the Black Commentator, which is the predecessor to Black Agenda, on Cynthia McKinney's loss to a corporate-backed candidate in her congressional seat in Atlanta. And my headline said something like Cynthia McKinney and something about a dignified defeat. So I get a letter, an email, from some guy who says, well, she certainly was defeated, but I don't know how dignified that was. And that was Bruce Dixon. And he then proceeded to do an analysis of why Cynthia McKinney was defeated, because she had been quite popular in that district. And it was an analysis. It was not a screed. It was not a rant. It was an analysis. And the Black Commentator, like Black Agenda Report, analysis is our stock and trade. So I immediately struck up a conversation with Bruce Dixon that only ended yesterday when he exited the scene. Bruce Dixon has been part and parcel, left his mark, has been sometimes the prime shaper of Black Agenda Report. When we say managing editor, he made possible the things that we do that less skilled people like myself cannot do, as well as doing everything that I could do just as well as I could. So we've lost not just a right arm, but an arm and a leg, and it's going to be quite difficult continuing without Brotherhood Bruce. We'll try, because he didn't let multiple myeloma slow him down until it stopped the cold. Up until not this past Wednesday, but the Wednesday before, he was determined to be here today until the doctor told him to go into the hospital the next day, and he never emerged. But Bruce will never leave Black Agenda Report. He is a permanent fixture. We must consider what Bruce would have said and how Bruce would have moved this project forward every time we come upon a problem, an idea, or an opportunity.
That was Bar Executive Editor Glenn Ford. Margaret Kimberly is an editor and senior columnist of Black Agenda Report. She and Glenn co-founded the publication along with Bruce Dixon 13 years ago. Kimberly paid her respects to Dixon. She also found some comic relief in the antics of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who is one of the 20-something Democratic candidates for president. At the debates in Miami, de Blasio seemed to be channeling the ghost of Che Guevara.
I'll start out by saying, hasta la victoria siempre. And unlike our mayor, I don't know if you saw this news story about our glorious mayor, Bill de Blasio, who, for reasons known only to himself, is among the cast of thousands running for the Democratic Party nomination for president. And he was in Florida for the debates, and he was, I think it was an airport strike of airport workers, and he says, hasta la victoria siempre, which is fine. But he didn't know, apparently, that the phrase is associated with Che Guevara. And of course, being in Florida with the large Cuban community, this became a problem. And he quickly retreated. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know who said it. And so sorry, sorry, sorry. And but now that I know it was so connected with Che, I'm going to say it more often because I do know it. So I think we should all, it's now a hashtag. We shall be, yes, and then we'll get up. But this, I tell this story, it's so easy to poke fun at Democrats these days. And that story tells us the problem that Black people have in dealing with this system. At this stage in the empire, it's a particularly difficult moment, especially now that the elections have started. And we're told that this is the only way for us to organize, the only way to be heard, the only way to make any changes is through the electoral process. Now, I'm not going to say don't use the electoral process, but Americans are told this is all you got, and especially in the wake of the Trump presidency, we are browbeaten into supporting the Democrats. And anyone who didn't vote for the Democrats is blamed, how convenient for them, for Trump being in the White House. So this campaign that started, there was not one but two debates this week. And I couldn't watch them, it's just too hard for me. But then at the same time, I kind of regret it, so I'm relying on news reports and what my friends have said on social media. So they've begun the dog and pony show, and we see how people are propped up by the corporate media, Joe Biden, Joe Biden, Joe Biden, who apparently didn't do well in the debates, And apparently Kamala Harris came at him and made him look stupid, which isn't hard because he is stupid, as I wrote in my column this past week. But a funny thing happened. One of Biden's fundraisers, a man whose name I don't know, named McInerney, he's a check bundler in California, and he said yesterday, I'm not gonna raise money for Biden anymore. And that means Biden is toast. If the rich people say they're not gonna raise money for him. Now recently, they, just to show you how bad he was, they had to hide him. They were hiding him from the press, but he did not hide himself from the people who write the checks. And he told them that he needed them very badly, and he said, he assured them, nothing will fundamentally change if I become the president. But it doesn't matter now. You know, they always need people who can look good. They have to be good for the brand, and apparently Biden is not anymore. So it's partly funny to me that he's already been shoved under the bus because of his dismal performance, but that also tells us we don't have a democracy. That if the people who write the checks and bundle the checks can decide who does or does not become president, then that is proof positive that we do not have a democracy. And I think that's something that has to be said so that people don't spend the next year and some months thinking that there's a democracy for them to protect or restore or bring back or save from the evil Trump. And he is evil, but we didn't have democracy before January 2017, so we can't blame him for everything. So now we begin with the, as I said, the dog and pony show with the debates. And in reading about them and listening to what other people said, it seems to me that once again, they did not raise any of the issues that are of importance to black people in particular, to the whole country. We are living under the threat of war. Trump, it's so hard to read what he will and won't do. But apparently, he decided not to start a war with Iran, at least as of last week, who knows, today or tomorrow. And at this very moment, when major powers are taking sides, what are Democratic candidates saying? These people, this party that black people cling to, that we're told are our only saviors, what are they saying about war? They're either saying nothing at all, or they give this mealy-mouthed double talk. The president has to come to Congress before he starts a war. Well then, what are you going to say if he comes to Congress? Are you going to say yes, or are you going to say no? That means they would say yes if he did go to them and make a good enough case. So we have a couple of people taking an anti-war stance, but those are the people dismissed by the corporate media. And not only are we dealing with the war, the conventional warfare that we all know of, bullets and bombs, but we also have sanctions, which are not new to the United States. Sanctions have been in use, for example, against Cuba for almost 60 years. In recent years, the Trump administration has really ramped up sanctions. And a study recently indicated that sanctions have killed 40,000 people in Venezuela alone. And let's just remember something about U.S. government sanctions. They not only mean that Americans or businesses or the government cannot do business with the targeted nation, but any other nation that does so is also targeted. And that means U.S. sanctions are international sanctions. That means that no one can do business with Venezuela or with Iran or with Zimbabwe without also suffering America's threats of force and impoverishment. Iran went through this process of the so-called Iran nuclear deal in exchange for sanctions being lifted or relaxed. Trump unilaterally pulls out. Iran waits a year, a full year, waiting for the Europeans to make good on their promise and do something to help them. Of course they don't. And now they say they will resume uranium enrichment. But who does the media tell us is the villain? The other one is Iran. It's very interesting watching the news story of the shootdown of the drone, which was not in international airspace, it was in Iranian airspace. But this is a moment for the people who we're told are representing our interests to say something. But of course, when they do say something, it's all about being tough with Iran. It's being tough with Russia, being tough with China, being tough with somebody. But no one, or very few people, I should say, expressing an anti-war voice. And these issues do concern the entire country, but they concern Black people in particular. This is a moment when we need to revive, and many of us are reviving that position that Black people always had. We were always the people most skeptical of war. We were always the people who questioned what our country said about other countries. That we suffered after Obama became president, and he's still hanging around, so I guess as long as he's alive, we still have to fight against that. But we must separate ourselves from these people that we are told are our only savior. Have they talked about mass incarceration? Now, I understand Kamala Harris is calling herself a progressive prosecutor. She's a progressive prosecutor. I don't know if prosecutors get to be called progressive, especially her, putting Black mothers in jail if their kids skip school and fighting against a prison overcrowding measure. But she could be the next one that they prop up now that Biden flunked his test. But we can't be fooled by her. We've seen this movie. We know the ending. So they don't talk about mass incarceration except to lie, the ones who help the mass incarceration system, like Harris. Unemployment, raising the minimum wage, all of these things that people need and want are not being discussed. And the person most identified with raising some of these issues is Bernie Sanders. And the reason there are how many people running for president among the Democrats is to 20-some-odd, to make sure that he doesn't get the nomination. So this is where we are. And it's going to be funny to see, you know, as of a week or so ago, most Black politicians were backing Biden. They were excusing his racist remarks that go back decades. He had the protection of Obama, and he was chosen by Obama, I think, for that reason. He was chosen so that Obama could make clear, that he hadn't already by the time he chose the running mate, that he wasn't going to do anything for Black people. But now, he doesn't have that protection anymore, and it all came out, and we saw who the Blackness leaders, as we call them in Black Agenda Report, we saw whose interests they serve. So it'll be interesting to see, it'll be funny to watch how they try to weasel out of supporting this man who now the rich people aren't supporting anymore. So I started off by talking about Bill de Blasio and his comedic attempts to be leftish. But I think he exemplifies all the problems we have with Democrats, all the problems we have with the people who call themselves liberal, and how worthless they are to us. And we have to also talk about what happens if a Democrat wins in 2020. What will happen for Black people? It's pretty clear that our choice comes down to the overt racist versus the covert racist. We have a party where, and it's not just Biden who bragged about the crime bill. That was Bill Clinton's crime bill also. And the man that we were told we had to support. So we're back there again. Even when we win, we lose. And we're going to keep losing unless we jettison the whole project. Unless we begin the process of leaving the Democratic Party. I think that is essential for all progressives. If people make us a progressive or left, we must leave this party. They are the problem. They give an illusion. They live on past history of decades. It's been a very long time since they did anything for the people. We need a real people's party, a real workers' party, a real peace party, and it's not them. So at this moment, when the empire is in such crisis, it's important for those of us who are come to events called Left Forum It's important for us to stake out new ground. It's important for us to say it is not with the Democrats. And we have to be brave. We can't let people tell us it's our fault if Trump wins or any Republican wins. I have several responses to that. First of all, how do you raise $1 billion? Hillary Clinton raised $1 billion. How do you raise $1 billion if you're not the one in the White House? You raise that much money, you couldn't get 80,000 more votes, roughly, that she would win in those states that flipped. Well, you can't if you're spending all your time covering up your dirt and trying to create dirt for Trump, then you can't do something simple like a get-out-the-vote effort. Then we have to talk about the fact that black people's votes are stolen. Voter suppression efforts all across the country that are increasing. And not just suppression, but outright vote theft. It has been proven in states like Michigan, which Hillary Clinton lost by just 10,000 votes. There were areas where black people's votes just were not counted. And that doesn't come up. It doesn't come up even with the Democratic Party. So I think to sum up, it's pretty clear that we have to be unafraid. It is essential, in fact, at this moment in history, that we escape from the bonds of this corruption that is hurting people all over the world. Well, I heard this morning briefly the G20 summit is happening in Japan, and they're already trying to weasel out of the climate change accords. The planet is in peril. Europe has experienced this horrible heat wave. This is happening all over the world. So we're talking about life and death for everyone. So the Green New Deal, which it's so funny to me, the Greens were supposed to be the villains that caused Trump to win, but the Democrats steal the name of the program anyway, at any rate, to try to make it look like they're the ones who are actually doing something. And there are people all over the world who are doing things. I don't know if you've seen the news story from Germany, where people literally blocked a coal mine, a new coal mine, to prevent it from opening. And that's the sort of thing we have to do. We have to accelerate the crisis. We only get change when the people bring crisis to the system. And watching these debates, I guess you can watch them if you want to. I guess you have a stronger stomach than I do, it's okay. But we can't get fooled by this again and think that Elizabeth Warren is better than this one, or this one is better than that one. It's all a setup for us. And this is the moment to turn our backs on this charade. It's our moment to stake our claim, to plant our flag elsewhere, and to stop supporting this system, which is taking us all down. So with that, I thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
Denny Haifong is a regular contributor to Bar and a co-author of a new book titled American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Haifong was part of the Bar panel at the Left Forum. He began with some words on the dearly departed Bruce Dixon.
I wrote on my remarks, I always write up remarks, a word about Bruce. It's been quite a rough 24 hours to 48 hours. And a word about Bruce is kind of ridiculous because I don't think we have enough words that we can say about him and all of his service to the people. I will say that he was very important to me. When I first came around Black Agenda Report, you know, I had done labor organizing, I had been, you know, part of Occupy Wall Street. I was really confused about the Black Lives Matter movement, especially I had been involved a little bit in that, and I was getting a lot of backlash because I was affiliated with Black Agenda Report, and Black Agenda Report was making criticisms of the Black Lives Matter network organization and the various strands of that movement in order to move it forward. And because I was associated with Black Agenda Report, there was a lot of ill feelings, and I was in Boston at the time. So I could just call up Bruce, and he would really advise me and really show me what discipline I needed to remain committed to the truth. And I think that's one thing that I really take away from him and his legacy, and I hope that we can all carry it forward. So I'll just begin. I have some brief remarks. And I think the real question that I'm trying to answer, and I think we all are, is, you know, what is the role for those of us who are oriented toward the struggle of the working class, like myself, in the struggle for peace, and who take our cues from the Black Liberation Movement, which, as we all know, the left in general, the Black Liberation Movement, has been in retreat for some time. There are many right answers to this question and many wrong ones. But one of the most important tasks that I see right now is the development of an anti-imperialist political consciousness. Anti-imperialism is a higher level of theoretical analysis than simply opposing war, as important as that is. New polls have shown that U.S. voters in the Republican Party camp are actually more anti-interventionist than those in the Democratic Party camp. And that was pulled around the question of Syria in 2013 when Obama was looking to draw his red line on that country into the Stone Age. Anti-imperialism is a revolutionary political orientation that breaks through the limitations of the two-party duopoly. It serves as an ideological framework from which organizations like the Black Alliance for Peace and others have attempted to take up. To me, anti-imperialism is the only antidote for US-led global austerity. Bernie Sanders' anti-austerity platform, branded as democratic socialism, has made him both the most popular politician in the US and the politician that has been most attacked by the Democratic Party. His demands, however, are not anti-imperialist in scope and thus fall short of a legitimate challenge to austerity. In many ways, they don't fit the category of anti-war either. Indeed, Sanders is opposed to some wars, such as the potential U.S. invasion of Iran, the Saudi-led war but U.S.-backed invasion of Yemen, and his historic opposition to U.S. support for Contras in Central America during the 1980s. The New York Times even called Sanders, quote-unquote, foreign minister of Burlington, Vermont, when he was a politician there, the mayor, in response to this anti-war history. And the use of this anti-communist slur really shows how anti-war politics in all forms across the entire ruling class are wholly unacceptable, regardless of how selected they may be. But Sanders is running within the belly of the war party, so we really can't get an understanding of imperialism from him. And we also can't develop an understanding of imperialism from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or her affiliates, whose speeches continue to invoke American exceptionalism and nationalist pride around the U.S.'s role in World War II, for example. The leftish elements in the Democratic Party have little problem with the fact that U.S. military supremacy is the backbone of U.S. imperialism. Any Democrat who dares challenge the war machine is effectively marginalized. We see this right now, even though she's far from an anti-imperialist. Tulsi Gabbard has been blacked out from major polls and corporate media networks for just uttering the notion of anti-interventionism. When she has been discussed, it is to smear her as a Putin's puppet or a dupe of Russia, despite her long history in the US military. Anti-imperialism is more than just anti-interventionism. It is a materialist analysis of the central role of finance capital in the current epoch of global capitalism. Finance capital is the dominant force of the world capitalist system at this time. There are good reasons why the International Monetary Fund has warned against the effects of corporate debt, why the U.S. possesses $1.6 trillion in student loan debt, or why the U.S. government carries trillions of dollars worth of its own national debt, as they call it. Monopolies rule, and the banks are king. Finance capital has become fat from austerity and creates whole markets for itself out of the misery of capitalism. U.S. capitalism has become dominated by finance capital precisely because the inherent contradictions of the system have turned into antagonisms. Capitalists derive profits from labor, which is a really important concept, and do so by increasing the rate of exploitation, paying workers less, and speeding up production by spending money on technology and investing in it. Competition between capitalists toward these ends have led to an unprecedented but inevitable level of capital concentration. Monopolization has driven the conditions of the vast lot of humanity into barbarity and has simultaneously increased the cost of technological investments in production and in the military, which are wholly interrelated, to maintain the super profits of the super rich. The parasites in finance capital have swooped to pad the profits of major corporations and the ailing living standards of the poor with no shortage of debt schemes. Since 2008, households, corporations, and governments worldwide have taken out $43.8 trillion of debt. The sector of finance capital comprises of over 40% of all U.S. corporate profits, up from just 10% 30 years ago. What makes democratic socialism neither anti-imperialist nor socialist is that it does not center the proletariat or the oppressed in the making of history. Black America created the value and continues to create the value and wealth of this empire, and workers all over the world remain at the center of production, of the large but largely fiat-based profits of finance capital. Without the complete and utter immiseration of the working class and oppressed, finance capital and Wall Street would wither away. Privatization, predatory lending, and endless war are all preconditions to finance capital's hegemony, which help it devour the economic landscape. Anti-imperialism is a necessary intervention because it is not just a narrow program that performs individual aspects of the imperialist albatross. It is a spear in the heart of that albatross, the struggle for the complete transition of power from the exploiting to the exploited classes. So the question really is, what is there a successful example of anti-imperialism in the world today? I think that there is a feared example of anti-imperialism in the world today that must be discussed in all leftist circles and organizing and activist efforts, and that's China. Leftists of many political persuasions, however, especially in the United States, claim that China is no longer a socialist country. Some claim that it's an imperialist country seeking to devour Africa whole. Yet many of China's most powerful industries, such as the Huawei Corporation, which has made the news due to the U.S. jailing of their CEO, it's owned by 90% by a trade union committee. China has lifted 800 million people out of poverty since 1978, and over that same period, real wages for the bottom half of the country have risen by 401%. Real GDP growth in China has averaged 10%, well above the sluggish 1-3% growth experienced in the United States since the 2008 economic crisis. China is not merely an emerging world power, it is an ascendant alternative to U.S. imperialism. Again, leftists criticize China for allowing capitalist free market forces to invest within the country. During the swelling global economic crisis of the late 1970s and early 1980s, China had to decide: become the first fallen soldier in the war against socialism, or adjust and protect not only the revolution, but also the imperative of raising the standard of living for the people. The People's Republic has set its sight on curbing predatory, volatile, and warmongering hostilities of the United States by offering an economic development model to the planet's most impoverished peoples. This is what the New Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road Initiative, seeks to accomplish with over $1 trillion of public spending on infrastructure projects across the global south. China's respect for international law and its development goals offer a real-time example of anti-imperialist progress, not perfection, but progress, in a historical moment where the U.S. is waging war on the entire planet to curb the rise of the People's Republic. The only path forward from austerity is anti-imperialism. This doesn't mean that the Sanders camp or the large majority of people in the United States who favor reforms such as the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, or other such policies should be negated, ignored, or condemned. What it means is that without a tireless struggle against the forces of imperialism, we lose sight of who and what is at the center of austerity. We end up falling into the politically suicidal and reactionary trap of national chauvinism, white supremacy, and American exceptionalism. The struggle to develop a black liberation strategy is dependent not only on the objective conditions of systemic failure, but also on the subjective effort of the whole left to defeat the forces of reaction that exist within its own ranks. And Margaret Kingley did a great job talking about how the Democratic Party is the biggest problem. The future of humanity depends on the anti-imperialist struggle within the belly of the beast. A handful of individuals own more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population. Julian Assange is being tortured behind bars in the United Kingdom while dozens of key leaders in the Black Liberation Movement and affiliated movements continue to experience what has been decades-long torture within U.S. prisons. All the while, oligarchs such as Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris, and the like display fake gestures of resistance to the big orange menace Donald Trump. Austerity lays at the roots of these dire conditions. Reversing the course of political, economic, and social collapse will require a massive upheaval not yet seen in the history of the United States. While there is no crystal ball as to if or when such an upheaval will occur, we must understand that the Black Liberation Movement is our best hope for survival, and that anti-imperialism is a key quality in the people's antidote to austerity. Thank you.
That was Bar contributor Danny Haifong. Bar executive editor Glenn Ford followed Haifong on the panel. He talked about why it's necessary to have publications like Black Agenda Report.
It's our duty to figure out what the rulers are most likely to do to us and what we should be trying to do to them, to bring this capitalist era to an end as bloodlessly as possible, so that we can get closer to Black liberation and socialism and a world at peace. The defining characteristic of this late stage capitalism is that the lords of capital, the financial overseers, have imposed a global race to the bottom in which all of the world's workers must compete with each other to sell their labor at ever lower and lower prices. The Chinese did not impose this regime. American and European capitalists imposed it. U.S. workers' living standards have been falling for two generations under globalist capitalism. The decline in U.S. living standards and in especially economic security is not a side effect of globalization, as it is sometimes described in the corporate media. It is the intended effect of this global regime that's being imposed. The capitalist imperial consensus, they are agreed on this, is to destroy all impediments to the most profitable exploitation of both labor and technology everywhere in the world. That means that not only labor rights, but all democratic rights must be curtailed. You can't do one without the other. The capitalists are determined to make money the old-fashioned way by ruthlessly driving down wages and rendering the vote and other democratic rights, which we used to call bourgeois rights, irrelevant to the actual governance of society. In other words, it doesn't matter how you vote. You're not going to get your way because of the mechanisms of capitalist dictatorship. At the same time, the lords of capital are relentlessly privatizing what's left of the public sphere and commodifying and financializing every aspect of human relations, everything you do with the lights on or the lights off. In other words, the capitalists are step by step creating a dictatorship like we have never seen. And I mean that literally. This is the brand new world that they're creating. I think we can see this brand new world that it has arrived in that even the definition of job is no longer what it used to be. I find it confusing when people talk about I have a job or I'm going to get a job, and I know that the employment that they're talking about is a relationship in which the employer has no obligations whatsoever to the worker and can let that worker go at will, and one in which there are often two classes of workers on the same premises. One, the contract worker, who has no rights, and one, the more formally employed worker, who will soon find themselves in the other person's category. And yet there is no nationwide social debate about this development. That is, the nature of employment is now something that is quite different. And these are not exceptions. 90% of the new jobs that were created under Obama after the Great Meltdown were these contract jobs, not really jobs with no obligations. That is the world of the future, a future of absolute insecurity. And I don't mean just insecurity in terms of getting a job, but insecurity in terms of what is the nature of my relationship to these people who own this place that I go to every day. A kind of total insecurity. Now, one can understand that that is the kind of society that will require a different kind of policing. Obviously, the mode of policing a population must change as the relationship of the rulers to that population changes. And so if there is no obligation on the part of the rulers to a worker, the social contract between the people who own basically the society and those of us who just live in it has been revoked. When we're looking at these shit jobs, that is the revocation of the larger contract to get along at all with these bastards who have billions of dollars. If they won't even make a commitment to something as elemental as a job, it is quite nightmarish contemplating the ramifications of this new society. But we need to do that. We need to have that kind of dialogue about a nightmare that has already arrived. And if we understood the real plans of the ruling class, which I've just outlined, never-ending austerity, deepening insecurity, inexorable erosion of what bourgeois liberties remain, and the irrelevance of the bourgeois electoral system, if we really understood that, I think that movement folks would be formulating different kinds of plans. But the most important thing to do is to break this news to the people as a whole. If folks understood what was in store for them, what the austerity dictatorship really is, I believe that even the reddest redneck would revolt from this degradation of humanity. And people can see it if we point it out to them. See the beginnings of this new society with the shit jobs that they are all quite aware of. But I think that even in left circles, these bourgeois democratic narratives and the skill with which both the corporate media and the social media have in focusing our eyeballs on what they want us to look like, short circuits are better judgment in terms of setting political priorities. So we want to talk about Biden and how he looked so bad. And we want to root, even if you're a Black Agenda Report, secretly for Bernie Sanders, even not as our hero, but as somebody who can contribute to breaking up that dangerous institution called the Democratic Party, probably more dangerous to us than the Republicans. But we're all talking about that and this new dictatorship of austerity strengthens every day. So that's what I want to leave you with today, to think about what is taking shape right in front of us, which most of us in our political work pay not enough attention to. And that's the equivalent of not paying attention to reality and getting too lost in their, as Danny would say, their fake news.
That was Bar Executive Editor Glenn Ford at the Left Forum in New York City.
Back in 1989, Congressman John Conyers first introduced his bill calling for a study of the question of reparations for Black descendants of people enslaved in the United States. The H.R. 40 legislation languished with few co-sponsors for decades. But this year, reparations is an issue in the Democratic presidential race, and co-sponsors are popping up all over the place. Plus, H.R. 40 now has a companion bill in the U.S. Senate, which means it is finally a serious piece of legislation. Last week, the House committee holding hearings on reparations heard from Katrina Brown, who produced and directed the Emmy-nominated film Traces of the Trade, a story from the deep north.
I grew up in Philadelphia, 6 blocks from Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell. I am a deep-seated patriot. So it was devastating to learn from my grandmother at age 28 that our ancestors had been slave traders, and to discover that the DeWolfs were, in fact, the largest slave trading family in United States history, bringing over 12,000 Africans to the Americas in chains. That these were my Rhode Island ancestors, and that Rhode Island turns out to be the state that sent more ships to Africa than any other, required me to reorganize my brain. The amnesia in my family matched the larger amnesia of the North, the self-serving myths of being always on the right side of history. I could no longer carry a sense of moral superiority relative to white Southerners, nor a sense of innocence vis-a-vis black claims on the white conscience. I decided to initiate a family journey to retrace the triangle trade. 9 relatives joined me, 2 of which are here today, and the documentary Traces of the Trade is the result, the subtitle being A Story from the Deep North. What we learned, how we stumbled, how we grew during that journey led me to become a passionate believer in the importance of reckoning with the history and legacy of slavery, a believer in personal and family reckonings, institutional ones, and larger national reckoning. And with that, in the need for repair or reparative action, which can and should take many, many forms. I express wholehearted support for H.R. 40, and I've met countless people of all backgrounds who believe in this form of national effort as well. I know there are many who strenuously object to the premise that we need this reckoning. The pushback I hear most often is, "That's your problem, given your ancestors, but it has nothing to do with me." It's understandable that people distance themselves. I'll focus on 2 reasons. 1, most of us learned a distorted history of slavery in school. So as white Americans, most of us don't realize our connection to it. 2, there's a natural instinct to avoid that which can bring feelings of shame about our people, about the country that we love. To address the first issue, here's a quick rundown of historical facts I had not been taught. That the North was deeply implicated, that slavery was legal in northern states for over 200 years, that Northerners up and down the economic spectrum made their livings in businesses tied to slave trade and slavery, that Northern mills processed cotton harvested by enslaved people. The Midwest and the West were implicated. They grew food to feed the South, where land was devoted to cash crops like cotton, harvested by the enslaved. Consumers throughout the country were implicated in their everyday purchases of clothing, coffee, sugar, rice, tobacco. People who immigrated from Europe after slavery were implicated. I have Irish, French, and German immigrant ancestors who came to the United States in the 19th century, worked in factories, struggled, but they were given access to the American dream. Why were waves of immigrants flocking here? Because it was the land of opportunity. Why was the economy booming? Why were there jobs? Because it had been built largely on unpaid labor. Once here, European immigrants got to systematically leapfrog over black families with devastating consequences up to the present day. So slavery built the nation. It turned us into an economic powerhouse due mostly to, I must say, good folk who participated in mundane ways and looked the other way. Now for the second big reason for pushback against this bill, the emotions that it stirs up. And I'd speak directly to my fellow white Americans on this. First, fear not. Though it's counterintuitive, I've seen over and over again the liberating power of facing this painful past. Second, white people tend to imagine that black people are angry at us. But in my experience, black Americans don't blame us for the deeds of bygone ancestors, but are rightfully angry that we don't just drop the defensiveness or the self-absorbed guilt and sign up to work with them, shoulder to shoulder, to tackle the legacies that are still with us. Third, when we let go of defensiveness or guilt, we can get to a healthy and shared grief, which opens the door to sober, sacred, respectful, creative, collective conversation about how to make things right. There are scores of organizations that are already able to attest to this, the power of this work. They know, I know, that the process that a commission would help the country embark upon could be a transformative, positive, and life-giving thing for the country as a whole. A beautiful thing. It is good for the soul of a person, a people, and of a nation to set things right. Thank you.
That was Katrina Brown testifying at the congressional hearings on H.R. 40, the bill to study reparations for the descendants of U.S. slaves.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has been incarcerated by the state of Pennsylvania for the past 39 years in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. Abu-Jamal has suffered a number of health crises due to atrocious medical treatment in prison, including a battle with hepatitis C, contracted in prison and left untreated for years. Now the prolific author and journalist is losing his sight. He files this report for Prison Radio. It's titled Walking in the Dark.
For years, it has been difficult for me to write or speak about myself. Other people's stories seemed more interesting. Until now. Several weeks ago, as I was walking along the main path leading from the chow hall, I noticed that I could no longer see a single face despite the river of men passing by. It was then that I recognized how bad my eyesight had become. I said nothing to no one, not my lawyers, not my wife, Wadia. I didn't tell my supporters, nor even my personal physician, a New York internist, Dr. Joseph Harris. For one thing, what could they do? For another, prisoners are extremely wary of telling other prisoners about their disabilities. One doesn't want to seem weak among such men. Every time I used an eye drop with steroids, my vision turned milky, as if someone pulled a white shade down over both eyes. I realized, to my horror, that I was functionally blind, for I couldn't read a paper or a book or even faces. When I went to an eye doctor for tests, a guard who accompanied me said, "Damn, Jamal, you're blind as a bat." He said this because the test showed I couldn't see anything, letters or fingers. That milkiness has since dissipated as I've stopped using the drops. Yet my vision has become so poor that I've used voices to recognize people, as a blind man does. My vision remains more than poor. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.